As we finish 2 Kings, chapters 21 through 25, we see the conquest of the southern kingdom of Judah about 150 years after the Assyrians had come down from the north to destroy the northern kingdom of Israel. At the beginning of chapter 21, Manasseh comes to power. He's 12 years old and behaves like one. For 55 years, he did worse than anyone who had come before him, and that's a really high bar. He not only continued in the practices of his ancestors by allowing idol worship, he actively promoted it. He even did worse than the people who were in the land before Israel conquered it in the book of Joshua, because he set up pagan shrines and images in the temple and in its precincts. Nothing worse is imaginable. And I think that it's key that the name Manasseh means forgetful. And it was his forgetfulness of the covenant and the people's forgetfulness, because you can't put it all on him. They participated in these pagan shrines. They had been and continue to do so. At the very least, they were complacent. But this name Manasseh, if you look back at Genesis chapter 41, verse 51, Joseph named the firstborn Manasseh, for he said, God has made me forget all my hardship and all my father's house. So he received this son, and it was a time of great rejoicing for him, an ability for him to forget the hardships that he had suffered. But this forgetful Manasseh brings great hardship to everyone around him. His sins are compared with Ahab's in 2 Kings chapter 21, verse 13, which is about as low as you can go. And God declared that just as Samaria, which was the capital of Israel, had been taken away, the same would happen to Judah. And this despite the fact that he had made a promise to David that his line would continue in perpetuity. And we'll see at the very, very end of 2 Kings, there's still hope for that, but we're not quite there yet. It offers in detail all of the things that he did in terms of idol worship. The judgment starts in verse 10 of chapter 21. I will cast off the remnant of my heritage and give them into the hands of their enemies. I'm in verse 14 now. Because they have done what is evil in my sight and have provoked me to anger. And, Manasseh shed very much innocent blood. We don't really know what this is, but the description is gruesome, until he had filled Jerusalem from one end to the other with blood. And we don't know if this is ritual slaughter. There's already been mention and will be mention in the verses and chapters ahead of human sacrifice, including children, probably on the altar of Moloch. Manasseh was just a nasty piece of work. His son Amon succeeded him. He did not stay on the throne for very long, a few years, and then he was killed by members of his own court. And this is where we begin the renewal movement of Josiah at the beginning of chapter 22. He was on the throne for 31 years, from about 640 to 609 BCE, and in the 18th year of his reign, he sent Shaphan to the temple. And we've heard this story before. The priests had been embezzling funds that had been given for the upkeep of the temple. So the system that they had devised was to basically have people make their offerings into a large piggy bank, where the priest couldn't get at it. And periodically, when it started to get full, they'd unlock it, and then he would distribute the wages directly to the builders, so to the craftsmen who were repairing and restoring the temple. without any account, because they were held as trustworthy, more trustworthy than the priests of the temple. While there, one of the priests, the high priest, Hilkiah, said, you know, I found a book of the law. We think this was probably Deuteronomy, and maybe it had been hidden during the reign of Manasseh to preserve it from destruction. So you've got an early form of Deuteronomy, and the king hears this and goes into penitence and mourning, tears his clothes, recognizes how great is the wrath of the Lord that's kindled against us because our ancestors did not obey the words of this book. So he sends some priests to the prophetess Huldah, and she confirms the fact that there's really no going back, that no matter what Josiah does in the way of reform, in declaring the covenant anew through the reading of this book, through the very thorough destruction of all the idolatrous places of worship, Judah's fate is sealed. But Josiah will receive his reward and will not live to see the conquest and the exile. And so Josiah is, I guess, to a certain degree motivated by the prospect of personal reward. But as king, he continues what was probably a difficult process, despite the fact he knew that in the end it was not going to make any difference in terms of the outcome for Judah. So this is obedience because it was right, because the prophetess had confirmed what Josiah himself suspected, that no matter what he did, he could not reverse God's decision on the punishment that was going to come on the people. So you get into chapter 23, and he really goes to town. He brings everybody together. He reads the law to them. Really impresses upon them the importance of following these laws. And then he sends out the priests who have remained faithful, and they start with the temple. They dump all the stuff that Manasseh put in there, the vessels for Baal, Asherah, his goddess consort, burned them outside of Jerusalem, carried their ashes to Bethel, which of course is symbolic because that's where one of the golden bulls was created by Jeroboam, to have an alternate site to Jerusalem to worship after the division of the kingdoms. He killed the priest responsible for the idolatrous worship, and it's just a catalog. Those who made offerings to Baal, to the sun, the moon, the constellation, and all the hosts of heavens. He brought out the image of Asherah from the house of the Lord, burned it, beat it to dust, and threw the dust on the graves of common people. And of course, remember in the law, contact with the dead was caused impurity. It was an act of defilement. So sprinkling the ashes of these things on graves was a way to symbolize how they defiled Judah, but also a way of sort of giving a final insult to these false gods. He killed these priests who had led the people astray under the rule of the king. He killed them. He burned their bodies, scattered them with bones, again, a way of defiling even their human remains. He household gods he confiscated, he destroyed, and just on and on and on and on, even to the altar at Bethel that was put by their Jeroboam son of Nebat in verse 15. He went after Astarte, Chemosh, Milcom. He just went on a serious tear. And he destroyed them utterly. And then he saw the monument, and he was ready to take that one down too. And they said, no, 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 it's the tomb of a prophet, leave it alone. He says, okay, fine. You really have to admire it, because the people had been worshiping these gods for centuries. And I'm sure that they were none too pleased about this, despite having heard the law proclaimed at the pillar of the temple. There's no serious resistance recorded, but it could not have been a terribly popular thing, but he didn't care. In verse 21, he orders the Passover to be observed. Apparently, since the very start of the monarchy, they had not observed the Passover, which is really shocking. This is the symbolic meal of their exodus from Egypt. And the Exodus is the core story of the people. I mean, the covenant had originated with Abraham. It persisted throughout the centuries. But this release from Egypt was really the time in which this covenant was extended to a nation of people, as promised to Abraham, as numerous as the stars in the sky, as numerous as the sands. So they observe the Passover, and then Josiah gets started again. He gets rid of the mediums, the wizards, teraphim, or these household gods mentioned. But in verse 26 it says, still the Lord did not turn from the fierceness of his great wrath, by which his anger was kindled against Judah, because of all the provocations with which Manasseh had provoked him. And so the stain that Manasseh laid on Judah in his 55 years of reign, you know, that was it. That was it. And I just admire Josiah. He was accounted more faithful than any other king. He's described as one who helps the forgetful people remember their roots through the observance of Passover. And remembering and gratitude are closely linked. I've included a quotation from Lightheart's commentary, "Forgetfulness is ingratitude, and ingratitude is one of the original sins." That'll preach right there. In the end, Josiah was killed by Pharaoh Necho of Egypt. He was on his way, it appears, to rendezvous with the Assyrians. The Babylonians were ascending. They wanted to moderate their influence, if not conquer them outright. For reasons that are not revealed to us, Josiah goes up to meet with him. And for reasons that are not revealed to us, Necho kills him. It may have been that he realized that under Josiah, Judah might rise. They were getting their act together, and he didn't want to have a potential enemy in his rear. So kill the king. And then we move on to the bitter end. We have four more kings of Judah. Together they reign for about 25 years, from 609 to 586 BCE. All of them were accounted wicked, and all of them, to one degree or another, ended up sort of being pseudo-kings. But they were really vassals of foreign powers. Jehoahaz was only in 3 months, and Pharaoh Necho imprisoned him, and then put a guy named Eliakim in his place. But the Pharaoh gave this guy a new name, Jehoiakim. And it's ironic in that that name means the Lord will raise, which is probably not what the Pharaoh had in mind. And this is just a return. It's a reversal of Exodus, because they're being controlled by Egypt once again. And names were very, very important in the ancient world. We see in one of the demonic exorcisms that Jesus performs, he asks the I think it's Mark chapter 5, where he goes to Gennesaret, and there's a man in the tombs, and he asks the demon its name, and the demon says Legion. And that was a typical formula for demonic exorcisms. If you know the name of an entity, you have a measure of control over it. Names and identity were closely linked. That's why the Tetragrammaton, YHWH, Yahweh, was considered to be so sacred, so holy, it could only be said by the chief priests once a year inside the holiest of holies. Purportedly, nobody else knew how to pronounce it, and they came up with euphemisms. Generally, when you see Lord in all caps in your Bible, that's behind that is Yahweh, Elohim, sort of a title rather than a name. So for this guy's name to get changed was definitely an expression of you know who the boss is. And he lives on the River Nile. Nico wanted a big tribute. We think maybe because he was saying, I want a ransom for Jehoahaz, who he had taken off as a prisoner. He never honored that, to our knowledge. The funds were raised from attacks on the people. And then in the eighth year of Jehoiakim's reign, and I put that in quotation marks in your notes because I don't think that we can use that with the full force it deserves, he switches side to Babylon. In 605 B.C., the Babylonians won a key battle at a place called Carchemish. And at this point, Egypt became a declining power. And with the exception of a few mentions in the chapters to come, they pretty much disappear from the picture. And so Jehoiakim realigns with Babylon, but then 3 years later, I guess the situation had changed enough that he then double-crosses the Babylonians in the same way that he had double-crossed the Egyptians, and he goes back to the Egyptians, which was pretty stupid because they were still in a relatively weak position and really could not help him much. In 24:2, it states that the Lord sent the bordering nations, who are now all under Babylon's control, to invade Judah. This was under the leadership of King Nebuchadnezzar, he was understandably angry. But what I put in the notes is this is less geopolitics at play and more theopolitics. So the motive came from Nebuchadnezzar, but the power for him to succeed and the real initiative in this invasion came from God. Because, yes, they'd broken a deal with Babylon. But the real deal that they broke that mattered was the deal that they had consistently broken with God. Jehoiakim took over then for 3 months, sometime in 598-597 BCE. Nebuchadnezzar quickly overthrew him after a successful siege of Jerusalem, and they plundered the temple and the temple precincts. They took everything of value. And it's detailed in here. Gold, silver, bronze, all of these things that Solomon had crafted at great cost to adorn the temple were all ripped off and taken away. And some believe that this is sort of where the Ark of the Covenant disappeared to. That it went to Babylon and maybe it got lost there, or maybe they, you know, didn't really regard it as a sacred relic worth keeping intact, and so they just melted it down. But some people think that some of the faithful were able to spirit it out of Jerusalem. And the claim is that it exists in a Coptic church in Aksum, Ethiopia. But, you know, nobody knows for sure. I'm kind of the Indiana Jones theory. We're in World War One. We took it back from the Nazis, and it's in a crate somewhere at Area 51. In addition to all the precious metals that they carried away, they also took the king, the royal household, his officials, anybody with special abilities, craftsmen, things like that, people who were useful. They took a lot of soldiers, which is normal. I mean, you want to, you know, prevent, you know, a potential insurrection, so you take the people who can fight. Nebuchadnezzar put up Mattaniah, and Mattaniah decided to fancy himself Zedekiah, which means my legitimacy is the Lord. And I think that this moves beyond irony to outright mockery. I mean, I'm not sure that Mattaniah was doing this consciously, but it's just ridiculous. He hangs on for 11 years. Now, you look at parallel passages about these events in other Old Testament books like 2 Chronicles chapter 36, Jeremiah chapter 37, 39, along with many others. These are just primary references. You can find plenty. They sort of see Zedekiah as a guy who really tried. Particularly in Jeremiah, the prophet reports that Zedekiah came to him regularly asking for advice. But whoever put kings together, that's not the way they see it. Zedekiah didn't do much better than his predecessors. He turned back toward Egypt, rebelled against Babylon. We think maybe because Egypt was starting to spin up again under, I'm probably going to get this horribly wrong, Psammeticus II, who became pharaoh around 592 BC. But again, they're aligning themselves with foreign powers, which the Torah consistently warns them against. And by doing so, they are explicitly saying, we don't trust God to protect us. We feel like that our future is connected with these foreigners, from whom we have adopted horrible, idolatrous practices that have gotten us into a whole mess of trouble. So the alliance with Egypt does not work out well. The Babylonians lay siege to Jerusalem again. It mentions that there is terrific famine, and somehow the king and his army got out of the ring. They escaped from the Chaldeans and ran for Egypt. Another reversal of the Exodus. They ended up being captured and slaughtered, except for Zedekiah, who was forced to watch his own sons be killed, and then and only then they gouged his eyes out. The moral of the story is, don't make the Babylonians mad. Jerusalem was overrun, and this time, instead of just taking away all of the goodies and some of the people, they laid waste to the city. They turned it into a ruin. The temple was just obliterated. The palace complex was obliterated. In a way, this is symbolic of the spiritual ruin of the people. Their sacred places, the temple where God's name was set to dwell, has been destroyed, and God is no longer with them, at least not in the way that he had done before. All that Solomon had done has been undone, and there's a sort of a circularity to that, because the sins of Solomon is what caused the division of the kingdom in the first place. And once the kingdom had been divided, it all spiraled out of control from there. They rounded up the priests. Whatever remaining prominent people were left, executed them. They took a much larger proportion of the populace and sent them into exile, essentially only leaving the poor who were there to work the fields for the benefit of Babylon. which had to be galling, and the promised land, which the people had conquered under God's mighty hand in the book of Joshua, had now been restored to foreign peoples completely, again, under God's mighty hand. Whenever you conquer some place, you need stability to get the money out of it. So Nebuchadnezzar puts a guy called Gedaliah as governor. He had a measure of legitimacy. His granddad was Shaphan, Josiah's secretary, which, as we've discussed before, was a pretty high-ranking cabinet position in the royal court. His dad was Ahikam, who was one of the guys that was sent to ask the prophetess Huldah, is it as bad as we think? And she said, yes, it's as bad as you think and probably worse. He told people, all is well. You remember that from Animal House? You know, Kevin Bacon in one of his first roles. You know, chaos at the parade. All is well, all is well. He said, you know, the Babylonians are going to be good to us. We're going to have security and we're going to prosper and everything is going to get better. And just a very small detachment of soldiers who somehow got left behind killed him. People realized that Nebuchadnezzar was going to be none too happy about that. And so basically almost everybody who was left ran to Egypt. So a third reversal of the Exodus. And, you know, it's hard to see how the complete and utter rejection of God's covenant with the people could have been rejected in a more powerful way. So it brings us to the very end, where it gets a little weird, as if it hasn't been before. In chapter 25, verse 27, this is around 561 BCE. Jehoiachin had been taken into Babylon 37 years ago, put in prison. But a new Babylonian king, the son of Nebuchadnezzar, rises to the throne. He's not there for long, a couple of years. And his name is Evil-Merodach. And I know, it's like, okay.
Yeah. Sounds like yes. Arrested.
This was a corruption of a Babylonian name. His name actually meant son of Marduk, and Marduk was a god. So this new king lets him out of prison, and then accords him significant privileges. He gives him a stipend. He sort of elevates him. So like at dinner, he's at the lead table, while all the other kings who have been conquered are you know, kind of at the kiddie table. It's really odd to finish the story like this, but this may be a foreshadowing of the fact that this exile will not endure forever. As we learn in other Old Testament books, after 70 years, when Babylon is conquered and a new king begins to rule, he lets them go. Now, not all of them go back. Some kind of like it, and they stay where they are. But some do go back. They never really regain the independence that they had during the time of the judges and then later in the monarchy. But at least they're back home in the promised land. Thus ends the story. So, what a journey we have had. Challenging as it has been, much better than the journey of the people we've been studying. Let me get my glasses on so I can see what you've written down. What does it say? Thanks be to God. Yes. The word of the Lord. Oh, you're so enthusiastic. Questions, comments, stuff you're seeing in these final chapters of 2 Kings. Yeah.
The most important question he hasn't answered is, are the Hanging Gardens of Babylon ever mentioned in the Bible?
It's a great question.
You know, in the head of us and that.
The eighth wonder of the world or seventh.
I'll be honest, I just can't remember. I just can't remember right now. My mind's very crowded this morning, and Does anybody know? Does anybody want to Google it to see if they're mentioned? I mean, certainly, you do see, I think, veiled references to the ziggurats, which were kind of these step pyramids that were built in that part of the world as worship centers, but also vanity projects. These ziggurats were, you know, they weren't like the pyramids in Egypt. They were step pyramids, and so you'd have these sort of, I don't know what you'd call it, porches? Let's call it a porch, where you could have a garden. And where you get really the first reference to that is the Tower of Babel in Genesis. You know, people came together and arrogantly decided that they were going to build a tower all the way up to the heavens, that way they would be equal to the gods. And of course, to thwart their efforts, God confused their tongues, and that was the origin of the many different languages that people speak that make it difficult for us to work together and get along sometimes. And that Tower of Babel was probably a reference to a ziggurat. Yeah.
So Judah was a little bit better towards God than Israel, so that's why they lasted a little longer.
Yeah.
Was Manasseh just the one who really said?
Yeah, I mean, Judah had two things going for them. On balance, they had better kings. But also, it was God's promise to David that his royal line would continue. What we see at the very end of 2 Kings is a hint that God's going to keep that promise, despite everything that's just happened. Manasseh, everybody's got their breaking point, and Manasseh was definitely God's. You know, in Daniel, several weeks from now, when we get to the second half of Daniel, the apocalyptic portion, it's going to talk about the abomination of desolation, which is probably, and Jesus quotes that as well in Mark 13, the little apocalypse of Mark, as it's called. And we're pretty sure that the abomination of desecration was when,
Antiochus.
Thank you. Antiochus Epiphanes IV in the 2nd century placed a statue of himself on top of Mount Zion. And you know, put it on the hill overlooking the temple. You know, put them here, put them there. But when you start sticking it in the temple, that's what today we would call a red line. It's just unimaginable what you could do worse.
And another thing, joking, my knowledge is bad, but the gospel goes into Jesus going back to David. Is Joachim the king who survived the carries on the line?
You know, I haven't been in Ezra and Nehemiah for so long, I can't remember that either. We can take a look at the genealogies in Matthew and Luke real quick. The problem with the genealogies is they're not complete and they don't agree.
Other than that, they're just great.
Well, I mean, I'm just sort of scanning the notes in my study Bible. There's nothing there. Give me a hint. There's no coincidence that Matthew and Luke are the only Gospels that have birth narratives and the only Gospels that have genealogies for Jesus. All of the Gospel writers are grinding axes. They're trying to prove that Jesus really is the Messiah because it was difficult for a lot of people, especially Jewish people, to accept him as the Messiah, because that's not the Messiah they expected. on the basis of the prophets. They are expecting a Davidic figure to come back to restore them to prosperity, get all their land back, and make them a dominant, independent power again. Jesus did not fulfill people's expectations. So the job of the gospel writers is to say, no, really, he was God's Messiah. We just misunderstood what the Messiah was all about. But to give him greater credence, he at least needed to be from the house and lineage of David. And so you have these birth narratives, and I'm not questioning their veracity, although it's curious that Mark and John ignored them. But they put that in there, and all the detail about Bethlehem, which is the city of David. And they put the genealogies, you know, going way back to the patriarchs, and in one case to Adam, with all these prominent kingly and priestly figures, as a way of saying, you see, Jesus really does qualify. He, you know, it didn't turn out the way we thought, but I mean, look at this. He really, you know, he ticks all the boxes, except, you know, for, you know, the whole crucifixion thing, you know, which is not something you'd expect from a Messiah, but even that turned out well. Let's see. Start with Matthew's.
Find Josiah was mentioned, but father of Jeconiah and his brother. Jeconiah, time of exile. I don't remember us reading about Jeconiah.
Well, and the thing is that some of these names come in multiple forms. And there's also some textual corruption. But generally, it's so, for instance, King Nebuchadnezzar can also be rendered in your Bibles as King Nebuchadrezzar, which is actually probably more accurate. Verse 12, Matthew 1, and after the deportation to Babylon, Jeconiah was the father of Salathiel, and Salathiel was the father of Zerubbabel, and Zerubbabel the father of Abihud, and Abihud the father of Eliakim, and Eliakim the father of Azor, and Azor the father of Zadok, and Zadok the father of Achim, and Achim the father of Elihud, and Elihud the father of blah, 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 blah. And then you get to Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born. And, I mean, these are typologized. Like in Matthew, you get three sets of 14, because 3 is a sacred number, 14 is double the number of 7. Yeah, I'd have to go back to Ezra and Nehemiah, and I can do that right now, just to see. And if you know, please do speak up.
Yeah, I was looking at you.
By the way, Ezra's right after 660. Ezra's right after 2 Chronicles. So just flip through 1 and 2 Chronicles and go from there. Okay, Cyrus of Persia comes in charge, lets them go. Loads them up with goodies. Big list in chapter 2. The priests rebuild the altar of God. I don't think they went back to a monarchy, to be honest.
Well, they had Zerubbabel and Joshua, right? The priest, and as leadership. I was trying to see who's the leaders when they come back.
Yeah, in chapter 3, verse 8, it says, in the second year after their arrival at the house of God at Jerusalem, in the second month, Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, so he's in the line, and Yeshua, son of Jozadak, made a beginning together with the rest of their people, the priests and the Levites, and all who had come to Jerusalem from the captivity. They appointed the Levites. They laid the foundation of the temple. Priestly stuff. In the reign of Ashuharis, in the succession year, they wrote complaining about each other. The only kings mentioned in here are Persian kings, Artaxerxes. Babylonians and Persian kings have the coolest names. Verse 17 of chapter 4, the king, the Persian king, sent an answer to Rehum, the royal deputy, and Shimshai, the scribe, and the rest of their associates who live in Samaria and the rest of the province beyond the river. I'm going to sort this out. Please get over yourselves. You have the prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, who have their own books in the Bible, introduced. They're prophesying, telling them to get their act together. So you see Zerubbabel operating in a role of authority, but the nature of his office is not clear to me. Suppose one might assume that he was in a kingly role, but as I'm scanning through the first several chapters of Ezra, the only time the appellation of king is offered is in reference to Persian rulers. And so you definitely see a dependency here, because one of the roles of the kings in Israel was to adjudicate, like Solomon did with the contested baby. And now they're basically sending telegrams back to Persia and Babylon saying, you know, could you sort this out for us?
And then the Persians run into the Greeks, right? So then there's no kings then. Jewish kings. And then that runs into the Romans.
I just don't think the monarchy was restored. You know, when you asked that, that was, you know, the immediate thing that came to mind. I wanted to take a look.
When you get to the hammer, the Maccabees.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder what line they were in that when they restored.
They weren't.
They weren't.
Yeah. That was the problem with the Maccabees. They took over the kingship. The Maccabees, in the Apocrypha, which I think you're familiar with, we hear from the Apocrypha occasionally in worship. It's like JV Old Testament. That's the way to think of the Apocrypha. It was books that were kind of on the bubble. You know, you ever watch NCAA March Madness Selection Sunday? There are the bubble teams. They were a group of books. They were kind of on the bubble, whether they really belonged in the canon of Scripture or not. And us and the Lutherans and Roman Catholics and the Orthodox churches all have the Apocrypha. We treat it in different ways. We are allowed to read it in worship for edification, and I can preach on it, but no doctrine can be established on the basis of anything you find in the Apocrypha. In the Roman Catholic Church, it can be. Other Protestant denominations just don't have it. So in the Apocrypha, there are two historical books, kind of similar to Kings and Samuel and Chronicles, called Maccabees. And it's named after this family that led a revolution against the Assyrian king Antiochus Epiphanes IV. And it was successful for a little while. It was 2nd century BCE, and Maccabees means hammer. In fact, in Israel, there's a beer called Maccabees. And its name is well earned, so be careful. It was a group of brothers, and they took over the priesthood. They took over the monarchy. The problem is they weren't Levites, and they weren't from the house of David. So it created a great deal of controversy and internal division, which is one of the reasons why this brief window of independence was as brief as it was. So it's a fascinating, gory tale. If you've enjoyed Samuel and Kings, you'll love 1st and 2nd Maccabees. Yeah. So.
Seems like that kingship was gone because they were always vassals or under procurators.
And it doesn't even appear to be even a monarchy in name only. Certainly there were descendants who had influential roles, but, you know, as I've scanned through the first seven chapters of Ezra, it appears to me that they are essentially on a par with the priests, which makes sense when you consider the prominence of the priesthood in the return from exile, because this 70-year period when books like Samuel and Kings and Chronicles were being assembled, these written works necessary to maintain a sense of coherent religious identity as a people in covenant with God, because you don't have the temple anymore, and you're in a very polytheistic environment, and as we'll see in Daniel, discouraged from worshiping Yahweh, you need these writings to maintain your identity, but also, what the hell just happened? And why did it happen? And how can we learn from this experience and maybe not have it happen again? And so Ezra and Nehemiah are books that are about the return from exile, and it's a process of restoration and getting off to a good start and rereading the law to the people, and trying to form a framework within which people can be more faithful to the covenant. But they never regain their independence. They're still under the Persians. Mm-hmm. After the Persians, Alexander the Great comes in. When he dies, he divides his kingdom into three pieces. And one of those pieces is roughly in the same area as the Assyrian Empire was. I think it was his maybe great-great-great-great-grandson who was a nasty piece of work, and exerted himself in a way that his predecessors had not. And then they eventually fall to the Romans, and, you know, the Romans are for a good long while. And of course, with the Romans, after a whole series of rebellions against the Romans, eventually you have this massive diaspora where they're not carted off to one or two places, but, you know, it's like, you know, when you hit the rack in pool and the balls go everywhere. That's what happened under the Roman rule when the Romans had decided we've had enough. Because when the Romans had had enough, it was over. It was over. And then, of course, Roman kingdom was divided, reunited, but never really. And then eventually this part of the world in the 7th century fell to the followers of the Prophet Muhammad after his death and was Islamicized. So it wasn't until 1948 with the UN Charter for the Creation of Israel that you see the restoration of the people. 2,500 years after the exile to Babylon.
Didn't the charter actually create two states, Israel and Palestine, or something? I'm not dreaming.
Well, I think that was the idea.
It never happened.
I was just curious why the other one never came into existence. If it had, I don't know if it would be less trouble or more trouble.
It was a messy time, and I'm not as familiar with the history as I would like to be, but my suspicion is that never worked out because Israel had to fight a series of wars against their Arab and Egyptian neighbors for sheer survival. So the sheer practicality has mitigated against a two-state solution. Ann, did you have your hand up?
Oh.
You're just waving to say, hey. You got to be careful with those hands when we're around these tables because, you know.
So, I mean, they slaughtered most of the priests and everything before they carted them off to Babylon, the Babylonians. I mean, there had to be just a few left, I guess, that kept the religion going.
Yeah, I mean, the faithful remnant. You know, that's a consistent theme. You know, a remnant will be left. A faithful remnant will be left.
Does he say, have I missed it being said in Kings 1 and 2 or Samuel, when he's saying it's going to destroy Israel and Judah, does it say there will be a faithful remnant?
Well, yeah, back when Israel was kind of swirling down, I think it was when they were fighting. Oh, Lord, who were they fighting? The Arameans. You know, God said 7,000, a remnant of 7,000 will be left. And it's consistent. You see it in the works of the prophets as well, that God never really gives up. You know, His wrath is true because He is just. And there's some things you can only learn the hard way. You know, you know, the best way to learn that you shouldn't drink too much is to have to deal with a hangover. And that's kind of what's going on here. You know, God tried and tried and tried and tried to motivate them to stay faithful to the covenant. But at the end of the day, it seems that only this would have proved sufficient. And it did work. I mean, when the people do return, you never again see the level of idolatry that occurred during the period of the monarchy, which is probably the chief reason why the monarchy was a bad idea. And God probably foresaw that, you know, power corrupts absolute, power corrupts absolutely, and that these kings would idolatrously see themselves almost as gods themselves, that they would succumb to temptation and do what all kings do, particularly at this time in this place. You marry into foreign royal households for security. You know, Henry VIII never married because he was in love. He married for two reasons. He needed male heirs, and he needed alliances to protect England's independence. And so it's the adopting the practices of other nations, which is the last thing God wanted, because Israel was meant to be distinctive, monotheistic, monolatrous, to serve as a light to the nations, so that they would let go of these false gods and worship the one true God. And, you know, and the people followed their kings that they had begged for, despite the warnings that this was a bad idea. So you get back from exile. You never have a real restoration of the monarchy. I'll do a little more research on that just to be sure, but I'm almost completely sure that you never see a sort of Davidic, Solomonic monarchy again. They really kind of try to lock it down. They end up, after several centuries, getting the temple rebuilt and restoring the sacrificial practices of ancient times. And you have guys like the Pharisees running around, you know, trying to help people observe the law meticulously. So, they did learn their lesson, you know.
They divorced their foreign wives. Had to get thrown out. Yep,
yep. You see that in Ezra and Nehemiah? You got a foreign wife, send her packing.
I'm just staggered when we read that, that they haven't, since the kings have come into being, they haven't observed Passover. That's what, 300 years?
Yeah, better part of 300 years.
I mean, that's astounding.
I have to be honest, and when I was prepping this over the last week, because I don't spend a lot of time in Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles, and I'd forgotten, and I was like, wow. Here's a pretty big problem that's just been ignored, which really says a lot about the type of problems they had. I mean, you think that would be a thing, you know, and along with everything else, the kings weren't having people practice the Passover, but no, so many worse things were happening that it doesn't get a mention until it's actually restored under Josiah. Caroline.
When they talked about this book that they found that was kind of a precursor to Deuteronomy, did that just kind of appear?
Yeah, we're not really sure. It's kind of weird. We think maybe somebody had stashed it away during the reign of Manasseh. And it could have been hidden away far earlier. It could have been just lost and found. I mean, that's entirely possible. And some people would say that this is a contrivance. One that foreshadows Ezra and Nehemiah. And in fact, some would even see Josiah as a prototype of what's to come after the exile, which isn't to say that Josiah wasn't a real guy and that he reigned, and that's very clear from non-biblical sources, and that he was a great reformer, better than all the rest. But I mean, as the story goes, as they were in the process of distributing the funds to keep the temple up, they found this book, took a look, realized what was in there, took it to the king. The king takes a look, and it's at that point that he remembers and realizes just how bad the situation is, which is why he tore his clothes. And then declares it to the people and goes on this rampant purge. I mean, I'm just imagining this just chaos. I think it would have been somewhat similar to what happened in the reign of Henry VIII with the dispossession of the monasteries and convents, and then even worse, what happened in the Protestant of Reformation with the despoliation of churches and the removal of, you know, all of their decorative pieces, the frescoes and the little tile things, what do you call those?
Mosaics.
Mosaics, thank you. And most people don't realize this, but you go into the icons, statues, and, you know, you go into one of these great old churches and in Britain or Western Europe, and it is pretty—it's pretty plain, it's pretty stark. And what you have to realize is, prior to the despoliation of the churches in the wake of the Protestant Reformation, these places were a riot of color. I mean, gaudy, and all of that was stripped away. And, you know, so, you know, if you reflect on that, that's sort of the parallel, the more recent parallel that comes to mind when I sort of envision Josiah and his little band of priests running around just, you know, chopping stuff up and setting it on fire and smashing it to dust with hammers and throwing bones over it for good measure.
I thought that most of this was written while they were in exile.
Yeah.
In Babylon.
Yes.
So this is the Kings was written then.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, to the best of our knowledge, a great deal of the Old Testament was assembled in a form fairly close to what we have now. It's not that they had nothing. They did have written documents. They had a lot of oral traditions. These were assembled and woven together. We can identify at least four different sources or perspectives, if you will, in Genesis. You see the heavy hand of a controlling editor, if you will, in Samuel and Kings, called the Deuteronomist. But as we've, you know, discussed repeatedly, there are little hitches in the narrative, whether it be in terms of a chronological sequence or an apparent contradiction or a real contradiction. And it's little places where the seams are rough, where this has been brought together, because the wisdom of our ancestors, I feel like if we were trying to write a Bible today, that, you know, whoever was the dominant faction, or maybe you take a vote and the majority wins, and you know, the story would be told in one way and in one way only. But the wisdom of our ancestors was to realize that the revelation of God is so great that no one person or group of people can have the sole accurate perspective on it. And so you have two creation stories. Well, why do you need two creation stories? And doesn't that, you know, undermine both of them, because they're different, right down to the sequence in which God created? Well, it was because there is a sense of reliability in both stories. There is a sense of truth resonating out of both stories. And so they kept them both, and they just put them bang, bang, right at the front of Genesis. And the second isn't a continuation of the first. There's no transition. It's just very abrupt. One creation story ends, and then in chapter 2, verse 4, another one starts. And you see that throughout. You see it throughout. Go ahead.
How long were they in Babylon?
70 years.
70 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A symbolic number, so maybe not precise, but a couple of generations. They were there about 70 years. Yeah.
And they were apparently allowed to do this by the Babylonians?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, as we'll see in Daniel, there were periods of time when they were discouraged from worshiping Yahweh. But this is a polytheistic system, and they're worshiping lots of gods. And so why not let these people worship their weird god Yahweh? I mean, we even saw last week the Assyrians, when they took over Israel and sent conquered people from other areas into Israel, lots of bad stuff was happening. And the Assyrians deduced, this is not working out well, because the God of these Israelites isn't happy because the new people we put in where they used to be doesn't know how to worship this Yahweh guy. So we're going to send some of these Yahweh priests down there to get these folks sorted out, so it can be better. So it's kind of like Leslie Newbegin, who was a bishop, Anglican bishop of India for a long time, and a great missionary, and he wrote several fine books. And he talks about how challenging it is to proselytize Hindus, because a lot of people think Hindus have many, many gods. They actually have one, but their god is manifested in many, many different forms. And so you can sit down with a a practicing Hindu, tell them all about Jesus, and they'll say, that's wonderful. And they will adopt him as another manifestation of God, but not as an exclusive manifestation of God. And that's sort of the way the ancient world worked. You know, the Romans didn't really care who you worshipped, as long as you played along and worshipped their gods a little bit too. I mean, now they made an exception for Judaism because in the ancient world antiquity was respected. And Judaism was on the map long before Romulus and Remus. Okay? And so the Romans did make a special exception for Judaism, although they were always interfering around the edges, which created a lot of friction. The problem that the Christians had with the Romans was once it was clear that this was more than just a wacky little sect of Judaism, that this was a different group altogether, that was not old at all. This is a new thing. And they will not make sacrifice to the Roman pantheon. They will not make sacrifice to the emperor. That's when, in the second century, you begin to see more systemic imperial oppression of Christians. Oh, it's 11 o'clock. So, let's say a prayer of thanksgiving. Next week, we'll move on with Daniel. Tell your friends. I know a number of people that have said, you know, I was in Florida for 3 months, or, you know, I've been traveling for work and I feel like I've missed so much that I'd come back and be so far behind. I'd have no idea what we were talking about. And so we'll be in Daniel for the rest of the year. It's 14 chapters, so it'll take us part of 3.5 months. And we'll start with an overall introduction of the book, and then we'll plunge into chapter 1 next week.